You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look back at the life of longtime Georgia Congressman John Lewis and his fight for racial equality, civil rights, and fairness. First, there's a lot we don't know about a potential fall season for college sports during the ongoing pandemic. One thing we do know, UW-Madison Athletics announced a uniform change. The white W on the crest logo would become a black one for this season, if there is one. It's not the biggest change. The notable part here is what inspired the move, a public letter from past and present student athletes. Here's a little bit of that letter shared on Twitter by a UW football player. Quote, "We, the current and former student athletes at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, request to adorn our uniforms with the university crest that displays a black W. It is our show of solidarity and commitment to the inclusion of black and other underrepresented students, that their lives matter." We have two guests with us now to talk more about the role that athletes play in social and political issues. Michael Jackson is UW-Madison's Associate Athletic Director for Development, Inclusion, and Engagement, and a former UW-Madison athlete with the basketball and track and field programs. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I appreciate the invite.
And Eddie Como is a professor of higher education and founding executive director of the Center for Athletes' Rights and Equity at the University of California at Riverside. Eddie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Michael, let's start with you. Can you walk us through the conversations, the background on this letter and this, you know, small but symbolic change on the uniform?
Yeah, I don't want to start off by necessarily calling it small. I think it's a big step forward for the program and for the students. And I think that's how we looked at it and approached this particular opportunity. We've been in conversations with the students really dating back to homecoming. Regarding just missteps that candidly the program has taken. And upon my arrival here, we've made it a focus to really come alongside our student athletes to ensure that as we make changes within the department, and that includes partnering more broadly with the community and the university, that we're not just presenting students with recommendations that they can respond to, but including them in the process from day one. And I think that's what we've been able to do over the past several months, even as we move into COVID. I was really proud to see the students come together with alumni with this initiative. It was something that we immediately sat down with them and really walked through, okay, how do we make this, how do we execute on this recommendation from the students, but what can we do to take it a step further in partnership with the students? And I think that's where we arrived at the additional component of having the Motion W in place as well, so the Black Motion W. So as you stated, the Black crest really represents University of Wisconsin. And it's really the, in the students using their words, it's their attempt to show solidarity with other students of color on campus. That was why it was very specific for our student athletes to adorn that crest. That's something that we work with them to ensure it was not only included on all of the uniforms, but they got a chance to see ahead in advance where it would be included and approve of where it would be included on their respective jerseys across all of our sports. That was something that was very important to us. We also wanted to make sure that they had apparel to adorn both the crest as well as the Black Motion W. And that is something that we've worked with them and made a commitment to execute on for the upcoming year as well.
And Eddie, you recently had an article in Forbes about the ways that college sports could advance racial justice. Can you talk about the importance of having athletes themselves at the table as they, it sounds like they were in this case at UW-Madison?
Right. You know, there's been sort of this racial reckoning, this sort of in this historical moment where we see more and more athletes that really see opportunities to advance causes around equity, around justice. And I think that, you know, what might be different from the current movement or this historical moment is that many athletes see these issues reaching beyond colleges and universities, where there's a common theme around Black lives, around this sort of humanity gap that I sort of describe here. And I really see them taking on this sort of presence that there's a need to do more. This is beyond simply protecting athletes on the field or on the court, but more so about human lives. And I really think that we're starting to see this sort of global movement around equity and justice issues.
And Mike, you talked about, you know, missteps that UW and maybe other institutions have made over the years. This is one step. What do you see as next when it comes to tackling these kind of issues and, I guess, learning along the way?
Yeah. There's a broad spectrum of things that we have to focus on. When you talk specifically to our department, we've taken steps even ahead of what we've seen unfold over this summertime frame to first and foremost implement an equity diversity council within athletics. It's an advisory council that is made up of former student athletes, but more importantly, alumni that sit in specific sectors that will be able to provide us guidance as we look to revamp our diversity strategic plan within athletics. It includes members in the broader part of UW campus. It includes members in community with specialties in everything from HR to diversity to higher ed to community engagement. We really wanted to build a council that could help us identify blind spots, but also best practices to be able to bring back to campus. Some of our key focuses within our new strategic plan are really first and foremost focused on the student athlete experience. Our students of color deserve to have the exact same high level experience at Wisconsin. That's in the classroom, in practice, on game day, but also outside in their social experience. So we put together a comprehensive plan that ensures first and foremost our students are serviced at that highest level. That includes and extends beyond our students to ensuring that our staff, coaches have that same level of support. And also, how can we partner more closely with the community, educating our staff across the board, as well as providing more outreach within the community? Because, as you stated earlier, our student athletes and our athletic department has a brand awareness and the ability to reach deeper and influence the community than some of their peers. So we have a responsibility to leverage that accordingly and ensure that our students of color, our student athletes, have the representation that they feel is appropriate.
And Eddie, in that Forbes piece I mentioned, you gave a list of some specific items that you think could do a lot more toward racial equity in NCAA schools. I want to key on one of them, increasing Black representation in coaching and senior level leadership positions. Can you talk about where we are and how you'd like to see it change?
Right. You know, part of my response to the George Floyd murder was to really think about how do we move beyond sort of performative statements to really think about a call for action, to really think about how we can address some of the sort of structural concerns that really have been lingering for more than, since the establishment of the NCAA. And so I put together a number of recommendations, but specifically, there is a gross underrepresentation of Black leadership in college athletics, specifically Division I. Majority of coaches are white men. When we think about conference commissioners, most of them are white men. And so there is a need to think about representation across the board, specifically around Black coaches, Black in athletic directorship positions, Black women in more senior level leadership positions. I think when you start to think about who is making these decisions, who's in charge of developing these rules of engagement, we want to ensure that it's reflective of the student body, right? Of those who are actually participating in the sport, that's engaged in the labor, right? That's really there producing the product. And so too often it sends the signal, if you don't have that representation in high level leadership positions, sends a signal that Black athletes, you sort of aren't welcome, right? That this is not a climate that's conducive for a wide range of students across different spectrums. And so that is one area that I certainly hone in on and really think that we could do a better job of certainly increasing the representation in senior level leadership positions.
We're talking about athletes and racial justice in college sports with Professor Eddie Cummo from the University of California, Riverside, and UW-Madison Associate Athletic Director Mike Jackson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about athletes speaking up on issues of racial justice? What would you like to hear or see from universities and their athletic programs around issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion when it comes to sports? If you are or have been a college athlete, did you feel like you could speak up on political issues to your team, to the campus, to the world at large? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Professor Eddie Como from the University of California, Riverside, and Associate Athletic Director Mike Jackson from UW-Madison, talking about student-athletes speaking out about racial justice and what colleges can and are doing to address concerns about the topic in college sports. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following athletes speaking up on social media and elsewhere about issues of racial inequality and treatment? What reaction do you have? Do you have when they make the case that, hey, sports can be political? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Charles is with us in Waukesha. Charles, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Charles?
I just had a comment of looking at what percent of the coaching staff is black versus white, only because I don't know the exact percentage of Americans that are black Americans versus white Americans, but just to take that into account.
Charles, thanks for the call. So talking about, I guess, proportions and representation. And Eddie, I think when you compare the population of student athletes at many campuses versus the populations of coaches, that's where you can see a big disparity. Do I have that right?
Correct. Right. When you look at the major revenue generating sports, football and men's basketball, you see a disproportionate number of black athletes in those sports. Yet when you look at those in the coaching ranks, for example, in Division I football, FBS, you have more than 85% of football coaches are white. And so that there is a disparity when you think about that representation. So that was specifically what I was referring to.
Thanks for that call. Mike, what do you see either being done now at UW-Madison in athletics or that could be improved in the future when it comes to training athletes, especially athletes of color, to be leaders, whether that's within the athletic field or beyond?
Yeah, we have a broad career leadership roadmap that's in front of us and that we've already began to implement. To address the issue of coaching, it really does get to the point of career leadership guidance. Are you providing those student athletes with a pathway post playing career that shows them benefits of getting their graduate degree right away, moving into the coaching space from the graduate assistant level and beyond, and really building a pipeline so that these student athletes that then go on into a career that is professional in their respective sports have the ability to move up the ranks more quickly. Specific to Wisconsin athletics, and I'm glad Eddie brought up the point of clarifying those revenue generating sports. It is important that we do a better job across the board of providing greater opportunity in terms of our searching out top talent, whether that's working with a talent search agency, putting out better ad spend and posting jobs in more relevant diverse spaces so that individuals who may not be tied to our respective university or our network have an opportunity to post for these positions, holding coaches accountable as we talk about review of their and expansion of their contracts. I think all of these things are under consideration, not just within Wisconsin, but it's something that we're talking about really in depth within the Big Ten's new Anti-Racism Coalition Committee as well.
Thanks for that call, Charles. Eddie, you are looking for a kind of a culture change in athletic departments. You want to see them taking on issues of, you use the phrase or the word, anti-blackness. You want them to take that issue on head on a daily basis, really. Can you give us a sense of what that would look like?
Right. So too often, when you think back of the policies of the NCAA and member institutions, we use the buzzword around reform, right? We've had the APA academic performance rating, which is really just a repackaging of reform, and we're continuing to get the same results. If you look at those who are penalized through the APR, for example, most of those schools are low-serving, low-resource institutions like HBCUs, right? And so as much as we want to think about sort of reforming and ensuring that athletes are developing their talents, matriculating and eventually graduating and contributing to the greater good, I often think that we're tinkering with the edges. We're responding to issues that happen and don't necessarily address the sort of core or central structural issues that do exist. And so as I think about these sort of performative statements and this sort of call for action that's playing out, I see their body of work, but I don't see the structural changes that happen. We tend to tinker with the edges of that. And so what I'm calling for is a centering of vulnerability, a centering of the Black condition, to really think about how do we address their concern. And of course, the first thing we do is must acknowledge that anti-Blackness does exist. There is this sort of idea that they are less than, that they are inferior, irrespective of their intellectual capacity, irrespective of their backgrounds or their contributions to the greater good. And so I'd like to begin by centering this vulnerability and acknowledging that anti-Blackness exists. If you're able to come out with a statement and say, I support Black lives, I'm in solidarity with Black people, after, you know, 8 minutes of someone's life being squeezed out of them, let me see the action. Let me see you centering the needs of Black people and ensuring that we're moving in a direction that addresses their racialized experiences.
We just have a minute or and a half or so left. Mike, what is next now for the UW-Madison Athletic Department, a big department tackling some big issues here?
Obviously, we're addressing some of the hardest times in the program in the department's history in terms of budget shortfall and dealing with COVID. But what's most important for us right now is making sure that we have programming in place and resources in place to serve our student athletes, regardless of the scenarios that they may face coming this fall. That really is our number one priority. We're going to communicate to our donors. We're going to communicate to the community as we get updates and remain transparent in that. But we've got to really make sure that we are putting in place a plan that ensures that our student athletes have the best experience if they're not able to get on the field or on the court come this fall.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Eddie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Mike Jackson is Associate Athletic Director for Development, Inclusion, and Engagement at UW-Madison, and Eddie Como is Associate Professor of Higher Education and the Founder and Executive Director of the Center for Athletes' Rights and Equity, or CARE, at the University of California, Riverside. We talked to him today about moves UW-Madison and other colleges are making to advance racial justice in athletics. From the coronavirus to nationwide protests to the economy, voters have no shortage of issues to focus on in the 2020 election. Republicans could soon release an investigative report that focuses on events from 4 years ago. It's been promoted by President Donald Trump, and as Sean Johnson reports, it's being led by Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson.
There was a week or so in mid-May when President Donald Trump started talking about what he said was a monumental scandal. He called it
Obamagate. It's been going on for a long time. It's been going on from before I even got elected.
Trump offered few details, and at a time when the nation was fighting a pandemic, the sudden barrage of Obamagate tweets from the president might have caught some by surprise. But not Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. In repeated interviews with Fox News, Johnson described in the gravest of terms the transition of power between President Obama's administration and President Trump's.
This is a serious, serious internal attack and assault on our democracy, the most serious possibly in our history.
Johnson chairs the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. He's leading investigations connected to Trump's Democratic opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden. There are at least two fronts. One involves what's known as unmasking, a process that happens all the time in the upper reaches of the federal government and the U.S. intelligence community. The U.S. is constantly spying on hundreds or thousands of foreign targets or agents. In the process, it might intercept phone calls, texts, or emails with U.S. citizens. These names get written into intelligence reports using obscure terms like U.S. Person 1. But high-ranking government officials can ask to learn the person's true identity. This is unmasking. And in January of 2017, Vice President Joe Biden unmasked the name of Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor. There was nothing illegal about this unmasking, but Johnson has seized on it. In early May of this year, Trump's Director of National Intelligence declassified this information. 5 days later, Johnson shared it with the world.
It is, from my standpoint, pretty curious that the Vice President of the United States would be requesting unmasking, in this case of General Flynn, 8 days before he left office.
Michael Flynn pleaded guilty in 2017 to lying to the FBI. This summer, the U.S. Department of Justice dropped his case. Johnson's committee is also investigating Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who served on the board of a Ukrainian oil company while Joe Biden was vice president. There's been no evidence that Hunter Biden used his dad to obtain favors for the company, but Johnson says he wants to know more.
It's not our fault that Joe Biden and Hunter Biden got wrapped up in the whole Ukrainian story.
Johnson is not the first person to float this idea. Remember, it was President Trump who was pushing for an investigation of Hunter Biden about a year ago, only he was asking the president of Ukraine to handle it. Trump's request was at the foundation of his impeachment trial. Former Michigan U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid, who served under President Obama, says there's nothing inherently wrong about Johnson using his committee to lead this investigation.
But if it is instead used the way that Hillary Clinton's emails were used, which is a non-issue used to smear her politically, then I think it becomes problematic.
Of course, Johnson is doing all this on the eve of the next election, with encouragement from President Trump. But the Cook Political Report's Jessica Taylor doubts that it will sway swing voters who care more about the pandemic, the response to protests, and the economy.
I think this is an investigation that can rally conservative voters, but those voters were largely with President Trump beforehand, and I think subsequently with Senator Johnson.
Taylor says it feels like an attempt by Johnson and Trump to change the narrative in 2020. But she says that won't be easy in an election that's a referendum on the president. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll look at the legacy of the late civil rights icon and congressional representative John Lewis. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, executives from the world's biggest technology firms testified before a congressional committee this week, addressing issues ranging from antitrust concerns to claims of political bias. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the hearings and possible changes in regulations in the future. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, civil rights icon and longtime Georgia Congressman John Lewis was laid to rest today in Atlanta. During his funeral at Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a pastor, former President Barack Obama said Lewis was perhaps MLK's finest disciple. Former Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton were among others to speak at the service. Lewis was a key figure in prominent civil rights battles of the 50s and 60s, including the Freedom Rides and the Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery. Here's a clip of a 23-year-old Lewis at the Lincoln Memorial during the 1963 March on Washington.
We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
Lewis died earlier this month of pancreatic cancer at the age of 80. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science and director of the James Walden Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University in Atlanta. Emory is located in Georgia's 5th Congressional District, which John Lewis represented for 17 years. Andra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I know Congressman Lewis was a big figure on the Emory University campus. Can you talk a little bit about your and the university's connection to him?
Well, you know, Congressman Lewis was our representative, as the story that I've heard is told. So I don't know if it can be verified. There was a choice about whether or not Emory was going to be in the 4th district or the 5th district. And there might have been some lobbying in order to get us into the 5th district. And Congressman Lewis represented my university ably. He made appearances at Emory numerous times. So that was how I got a chance to to shake his hand. One of the last appearances that I remember him being on campus that I was at, there was one at the law school more recently that my colleague Fred Smith moderated, was an event where Emory was releasing the papers that it holds in the Steward Rose Manuscripts and Rare Books Library from the SCLC. And Congressman Lewis, you know, was our keynote speaker to just sort of celebrate that we had these papers that were now going to be open and available for research. So, yeah, he's had a really close relationship. Right now, there's fundraising for a John Lewis chair that I think is going to be at the law school. And so John Lewis's name is definitely going to live on in our university community. We're going to be moderating sort of a program where we're going to watch the new documentary, you know, about him that's recently come out. So he will definitely be missed, but he won't be forgotten.
Now, what goes through your mind when you think of his legacy over more than half a century of activism and political service?
Well, he blends protest and politics in interesting ways. So as Bayard Rustin could see the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act on the horizon, he pens this really famous essay, From Protest to Politics, where he's urging African-Americans who have been out marching and protesting and fighting for full political recognition and rights to now use those opportunities that have been given them. And so his vision was that, you know, African-Americans would participate in voting fully and that they would start running for office, that they no longer, that they didn't have to act as though they were outsiders anymore, that they could claim their insider status. And so what we now know is that Rustin is absolutely right. African-Americans should run for office. They should vote. They should participate in formal politics. But we might kind of update what Rustin had to say by adding the words of a colleague, a sort of senior scholar in the discipline, the late Ron Walters, who was a political scientist at Howard and the University of Maryland, that argues for an inside-outside strategy, that you need to continue to use the tactics of protest to keep those who do get elected honest and to hold them accountable. But yet participating as an insider and claiming one seat at the table is also vitally important. And Congressman Lewis lived that out in his life. So moving from SNCC, you know, to the Atlanta City Council, to Congress is certainly evidence of his activist and his insider and sort of politician credibility, but also the fact that he continued to use protests. So whether that was supporting new social movements or the continued struggle for civil rights, or actually using protests, for instance, to, you know, stage a sit-in on the House floor to push for comprehensive gun reform legislation. We see the ways that that was embodied in his life. I think I'd end by also noting the generational bridge. So John Lewis being part of those champions for civil rights, those foot soldiers from the 1950s and 60s, sometimes may seem really remote from Black Lives Matter, but I think his last public appearance certainly demonstrated that what people have been out in the streets fighting for this summer in terms of civil rights, in terms of a recognition of full humanity, in terms of an end to police violence and over-policing, has direct ties to what he was fighting for with respect to voting rights and an end to Jim Crow in the 1960s.
We're looking at the life and career and legacy of the late Congressman John Lewis. Our guest is Andra Gillespie from Emory University in Atlanta. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have memories of his career, if you were inspired by him at some point in your own life, if you have questions about his work in the civil rights movement and in Congress, you can join in at 800-642-1234. In the days before his death, Lewis wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times that he wanted published on the day of his funeral, which it was. Here's a little excerpt of it, quoting here, "Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence is the more excellent way. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring." Now, you, Andra, talked about his work with other generations. Now, even after he's passed, in a way, he's reaching out to current and even future generations with that message.
Yeah, it was actually really moving. So I was pleasantly surprised to see that he had the four sight and the forethought to do that this morning. And so I think this again affirms this idea that he saw very clear connections between the protests that he was engaged in his 20s and the protests that we see people in their 20s and 30s and 40s doing today. And I think he was in many ways passing the mantle on. And we saw that mantle being passed as he stood with Muriel Bowser, the Gen X mayor of Washington, D.C. And through this op-ed, he is passing it on, if people didn't realize it, to these millennial and Gen Z activists who, you know, have been fighting for racial justice today, and letting them know that the fight is the same fight, that they are continuing the work that he built on, that other people had started before him. And he just wanted to just let them know that there was somebody out there who supported him. And so I hope that that is an inspiration to people. I think he's also, you know, very clearly laying out sort of his strategic commitment to nonviolence and sort of emphasizing why that is important as well.
Now, Lewis was among protesters attacked by law enforcement at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma during a voting rights march in 1965. He had told NPR that he was hit in the head with a nightstick, thought he was going to die. And now in March of this year, Lewis returned to the bridge in Selma to commemorate the 55th anniversary of what became known as Bloody Sunday. Here's a clip from some of his remarks.
You look good. You look colorful. Go out there. Speak up. Speak out. Get in the way. Get in good trouble.
Good trouble.
Necessary trouble. And help redeem the soul of America. Thank each and every one of you. I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to give in. I'm going to continue to fight. We need your prayers now more than ever before. Let's do it.
A lot of people have referred to the phrases of good trouble and necessary trouble. Can you talk about the role of good trouble in the life of John Lewis?
Well, it's basically about rocking the boat when it's necessary to rock the boat. You know, there are multiple approaches that African Americans have taken historically to deal with their oppression. And, you know, some people, for very, very legitimate reasons, for the sake of survival, chose to try to be quiet. So that they could perhaps avert the gaze of oppression and thus save their lives. And certainly Lewis's family encouraged him to do that because they didn't want for him to be a victim of lynching for all intents and purposes. And so what Lewis decided that he was called to do was he was called to be a disruptor. He was called to make trouble, not for the sake of trouble, not for his own personal gain, not for any selfish cause. But he knew that if he was a disruptor, even if it meant that in the short term he would have to spend a lot of time in jail, that this would actually end up helping to recreate American institutions and systems in a way that was more just.
We're looking back at the life of civil rights icon and Georgia Congressman John Lewis, who passed away last week at the age of 80. Andra Gillespie is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what John Lewis's messages of equality, civil rights, and good trouble means to you today. Do you have a question about him and his career? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our discussion and hear from a member of Wisconsin's congressional delegation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look back at the life and legacy of longtime Georgia congressman and civil rights hero John Lewis. He died last week of pancreatic cancer at the age of 80. Andra Gillespie is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University in Atlanta. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel inspired by the works of John Lewis and other civil rights protesters of the 50s and 60s? Do you look to them today? What do you want to know about John Lewis? Do you have thoughts on the politics and how we think of protest back then in the distant past versus how we look at protests happening now in the real present? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We have Congressional Representative Ron Kind with us now, Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District in western and southwestern Wisconsin. Congressman Kind, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thank you so much, and thanks for asking me to participate in this tribute to John Lewis. I'm honored to be here with Andre Gillespie, too. I've been listening in on the conversation.
And we've seen statements from, I think, just about all members of Wisconsin's delegation, Republican and Democrat. Do you want to share some thoughts or memories, Representative Kind?
Yeah, well, first of all, John was a dear friend of mine. I loved him. We served on the Ways and Means Committee, so I had a chance to spend a lot of time with him and hear his stories. And as a historian myself, I was always asking him questions about the civil rights movement and his role in it. And you can honestly say that he, more than anyone in recent history, brought our country a little bit closer to our highest ideals of full equality for everyone. And that was his North Star, and that's what motivated him. And, you know, all the beatings that he suffered from the Freedom Rides to the sit-ins to Bloody Sunday in Selma, he could have been a very bitter and angry individual, but he always felt that the open hand is better than a clenched fist. And he would constantly remind us that when you see something that's not right, not fair, not just, you had to stand up. You had to speak up, speak out, and find a way to get in the way, get into trouble, good trouble, he called it, necessary trouble, but always peaceful. And that was his life mission.
On a policy side of things, some of the speakers today at his memorial service, including former President Obama, called on Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act that has John Lewis's name attached to it now, restoring some of the voting rights that were taken away in a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Is that something you are looking to do now?
Yeah, absolutely, and we need to do that. It was a bad court decision. Congress can fix it. We've had legislation that passed the House of Representatives on a number of times, but I couldn't think of anything more appropriate than renaming that bill after John Lewis and try to put some pressure on the Senate to do the right thing and restore full voting rights. And this is really about making sure all the states are complying with law and not putting up unnecessary hurdles for anyone to participate, let alone minorities, in our voting process. So it's long overdue to fix that, and we need to be able to accomplish this. I couldn't think of a better tribute to John, given the legacy that he's leaving all of us right now.
Congressman Kind, thanks for taking a couple minutes to share your memories.
Well, thank you, Rob. We miss him, and boy, but what a legacy he leaves and a challenge for all of us. And just finally, the one thing that inspired him most was the young people that he sees out there today demonstrating and getting into that so-called good trouble. That, to him, was what it was all about. And so there is some hope on the horizon, I feel.
Thanks again for joining us. Now, Andre, I wanted to get your thoughts on how people view protests. I think we have kind of a more positive memory when we look back at protests of the past. But at the time, in polling and in public reaction and opinion pieces and things like that, it was not necessarily that popular. How do we orient ourselves as we evaluate protests of today, remembering that the things we look back on fondly now weren't so popular at the time?
I think that we should all remind ourselves and be really reflective of the fact that people's attitudes change over time. And so I think people like John Lewis and people like Martin Luther King look better in the eyes of history, maybe because with some hindsight, we can see the justice in their cause. But we have to remember that in the moment, they were actually really controversial figures. And so if you go back and you look at public opinion data, particularly about Martin Luther King, right, he wasn't universally loved. And I think it's also important that when we do kind of view him through rose-colored lenses today in the 21st century, a lot of people project a lot of things onto Martin Luther King and even to John Lewis that could be oversimplified and can actually not force them to actually deal with the more complicated parts of their message, the parts that might actually sort of, you know, chip away at somebody's privilege and actually call people to question, advantages that they have that maybe have been unfairly acquired. And so if we're going to deal with and lionize the leaders from the civil rights movement, then we have to listen to everything they say, even the hard truths that they point to with us. I mean, I think it's also really important to kind of point out is that today, nonviolent resistance looks very attractive in part because of perceptions of other types of protest movements. So whether we're talking about Black Power in the 1960s or whether we're talking about more confrontational tactics today, because it actually looks more tame. And so people are more comfortable with what they view as tame. It's also really important to remember that Martin Luther King was a radical. The idea of even doing nonviolent protests was something that was perceived as risky and controversial. And so anytime somebody is seeking to upset the status quo and to challenge those who may unfairly and comfortably hold positions of power, they're going to be viewed as threats. So the idea that people like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were both simultaneously being surveilled by the FBI, that Martin Luther King was being dismissed as a communist. These are all things that would suggest that what they were doing was dangerous, as obviously evidenced by the fact that he wasn't allowed to survive the movement, and that there was a lot of opposition to what's going on. So, the same way that like people want to say that they were at Woodstock, a lot of people want to claim that they were at the March on Washington. And I think some people need to be honest. And I think we're going to also need to be honest about this particular year as well, about sort of claiming a certain type of progressive sort of policy stance in action when it wasn't actually true in the first place. And I think we need to give space for people to say, even if I disagreed with certain things that perhaps I learned to evolve over issues or I was educated, we don't necessarily sort of all have to claim having been there, especially if it's not true.
We're talking about the late Congressman and activist John Lewis. Andre Gillespie is with us from Emory University. We also heard from Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind a few moments ago. Andre, would you give us some recommendations on how to go back and learn about the messier, less sanitized version of the civil rights movement than we get, from just, knowing two or three lines from the I Have a Dream speech? How could we give us a little lesson plan to go back and learn a little more?
Well, I mean, part of it is just doing more reading. So one, it might be to actually read the whole speech and to read that in the context of other writings. So in particular, there is that dream, King of 1963, but then there's also the King of Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community. So getting a sense of King's evolution and his intellectual development over time up to his death would be helpful. You may want to read Congressman Lewis's autobiography, Walking with the Wind, or actually look at his graphic comic book series. That might be a fun way, and especially it might be accessible for younger readers. I think for those who have access to college educations, whether that's at a community college or whether students are enrolled in colleges and universities, this moment is actually really, really appropriate in order to understand what's going on, to take advantage of the classes that are being offered in African-American studies departments and programs, and classes on African-American history and politics and on the sociology of race relations. These are all really important things to help us understand what's going on, to understand politics, to understand public policy through the lens of race. And I think that actually equips us to be armed with the knowledge to understand why people are putting forward certain types of policies, what's worked in the past, what hasn't worked in the past. And then also, in an election year, how to arm oneself with the tools and the information to be able to understand what's going on when candidates are making both positive and negative appeals to race, and deciding whether or not you actually want to receive that and actually sort of factor that into your decision-making calculus. But the only way that you won't be unduly sort of influenced by that is to be armed with knowledge ahead of time, so that once you receive that information, you can determine sort of, what aligns with your values and what doesn't align with your values.
Just 30 seconds or so left, Andre. With a towering figure like John Lewis, it can seem intimidating maybe to a next generation of leaders. Do you see that generation emerging now, though?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. So with the Black Lives Matter protests, a new generation has, assumed a mantle of activism. And I think it's also important to realize that, and President Obama talked about this today in the eulogy, John Lewis was in his early 20s. He was a regular person, a farm boy, and he, changed history. And so if he can do it coming from a farm in Troy, Alabama in his early 20s, then surely anybody can do it as well.
Andre, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Andre Gillespie is an associate professor of political science and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University in Atlanta. We talked with her about the life and legacy of civil rights icon and longtime Congressman John Lewis. We also heard from Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the numbers are in and they're not great. We'll check out the historic economic downturn marked by new GDP numbers out this week and look at the prospects for a recovery. The president suggested delaying the U.S. election in November based on claims of voter fraud by mail. We'll look at the politics behind the statement and find out why Congress would be the place to make decisions like that. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. This week, our guests share some great vegetarian recipes featuring summertime produce. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with a tour of the Ice Age Trail here in the state and some great ways to go for a hike. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then two friends join the show to make the case for making more time and space for friendships in our lives, even if they have to be long distance. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.